Despite losing two recent Mega Million dollar decisions at the Supreme Court, chemical giant Bayer AG vows to fight on for its glyphosate-based herbicide Roundup. This leads us to ask, what is in glyphosate for people who eat food?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned in to the 1319th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Yokohama who are tuned in to the Food Chain Podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, a few years ago, I was invited by the U.S. Farmers and Ranchers Alliance to participate in a panel discussion on the impact of recombinant DNA technology on the production of American crops. Joining me on the panel were presidents of the production associations for some of the nation's leading crops, including corn, hogs, soybeans, and wheat. Our audience consisted of the technology professionals attending an international biotech conference then being held at Chicago's McCormick Place Convention Center. The agricultural professionals on the panel were most effusive in their praise of the biotech technologies that have transformed their production of crops. When my turn came, I said, "Ladies and gentlemen, I was a teenage herbicide. I spent many of my summers, when in my young teenage years at least, hoeing weeds for the farmers of Montana's Yellowstone River Valley. It was hard work and it was hot work. I am here to tell you that the technology that you have developed is magic. It has made the people on the panel with me and the farmers they represent very happy. One farmer can now grow 1,000 acres of crops without having any pests or weeds. And you have made the companies that you work for very wealthy indeed. But one day, people who eat food are going to stand up and ask, hey, what's in this technology for us other than food that has been drenched in herbicides and infused with pesticides? When that day comes, I said, you better have an answer. What will that answer be? Well, that day has apparently arrived in the form of mega-million-dollar lawsuits targeting the glyphosate herbicide Roundup, which was developed by the Monsanto Corporation, which then sold itself to Bayer AG. Bayer's never-give-an-inch fight to save the glyphosate formulations from the predation of mega-million-dollar lawsuits leads us to ask, what is in glyphosate for those of us who eat food? Well, here to help us find an answer, we have the attorney who just cleaned Bayer's clock at the U.S. Supreme Court. Please welcome Amy Van Sauer, who is the senior attorney at the Center for Food Safety. Amy, welcome to the Food Chain.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So, that's a pretty big deal to clean Bayer's clock at the U.S. Supreme Court. Are you going to Disneyland?
Well, I wish I could take credit for that particular case, but I would say that what I was very personally involved in was cleaning their clock and EPA's as well at the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, as to EPA saying that Roundup does not cause cancer.
Right.
However, we also, did file what's called an amicus brief, friend of the court brief, in the Hardeman case, which is what I believe you're referring to, mm-hmm. that the Supreme Court recently declined to take, as well as the Pilliod case, which is a similar issue. So yes, we are extremely pleased about all of those decisions where now, all the tens of thousands of people who have come down with, or their loved ones suffered from non-Hodgkin's lymphoma can go forward with those claims against a Bayer. And that EPA has to redo its assessment of cancer risk.
So
it's huge news.
Huge news. It's this has been going for a long time. Now, is it over, or is it just another step in the long fight over the efficacy of glyphosate?
Well, it's definitely another step. You know, it's a big step, but there is more to be done. So EPA has to redo its assessment of human health risks from glyphosate, and that includes Roundup and all the products that include glyphosate in it. There are 555, by our count, products out there that have glyphosate in it, and it has to do that by October 1st of this year. So that is actually a statutory deadline that Congress set for EPA to review many pesticides that it has already registered in the past, to look at the new science that's out there and the real world data, and to see if it's still safe and still meets the safety standard.
That's not very long.
No, it's not very long. It's not very long at all. And, you know, EPA got itself into this mess because it did this, made this interim decision, knowing that it had to, you know, had to abide by that October 1st, 2022 deadline, and said back in 2020 that, oh, we're done with our human health assessment. We think everything is fine. There's no human health risk and there's no cancer risk. Mm-hmm. And so that's what led to this court challenge, which, you know, basically confirms that, like, you know, EPA, you can't just go and make a decision and call it interim and have it not be challengeable in court. And so, yes, they have to go back and redo that assessment. Luckily for them, there's a lot of evidence out there already. And it's not that EPA has to go and recreate the wheel or anything. There are, you know, reams of data, epidemiological studies that are showing this increased risk of NHL after exposure to glyphosate, and animal feeding trials. And what EPA, what the court said, is that EPA discounted all these things contrary to its own experts, its own guidelines, and just basic common sense. So what EPA has to go...
Let me ask you this. In listening to you talk about the EPA and its evaluation of the science, we see signs in front yards that says science is real. How do you justify that notion that science is real when you watch something like the EPA and how it deliberates the science?
Well, you know, science is real, but the interpretation of it can be political. And that's what we have been seeing here. You know, Monsanto for decades has pressured, lobbied, and even colluded with the EPA to hide the cancer risks of glyphosate. And so EPA goes and takes its science that's before it and finds ways to discount it. So they say, oh, well, that study, it's not statistically significant enough, or, oh, those, you know, the details are very technical. And the court, in fact, got into a lot of these technical details, but, you know, found ways to discount the tumors showing up in lab animals that were being fed glyphosate. So this is like the way that they can go and try to tamp down their own evidence, basically. And it is contrary to science with integrity. So that's the main thing.
Science with integrity. Meaning?
Oh, meaning, well, you know, you have to, you know, for, well, let me put it this way. EPA has its own guidelines about how it looks at cancer. And those guidelines are there to make sure that it's doing it the right way, right? It's not discounting evidence, but it's also, you know, it's being conservative where it should be conservative to protect human health. But it's doing it in a way that's sound science. You know, you hear that phrase a lot, sound science. EPA also has experts that it goes to, and it created a scientific advisory panel of experts to look at its cancer assessment and say, you know, oh, did you do this right? Did you follow the guidelines? Is this good science? And that panel came back and said, you ignored a lot of your own guidelines here, and you did it so that you could discount at every point the evidence of cancer of glyphosate. And that is not sound science. And so that's not the integrity of science that I know the Biden administration would like to see. So we're hoping for a change there.
Okay. Let's back up a little bit for the folks who do not know what glyphosate is. And kind of, would you sketch us in on the product itself?
Sure. So glyphosate first came out in 1974. And it's a weed killer. So it's very good at killing broadleaf plants. It kills a lot of different plants. And at first, it was just used, you know, to kill weeds in, you know, say like your yard, right? Or an agricultural use before you're planting anything or long after you've harvested it.
But killing the ditch banks and stuff like that. Yeah,
ditch, sure. Irrigation ditches, stuff like that. Rights of way, you know, under power lines, right? But in the mid-90s, as Monsanto was about to lose their patent on this product, they came up with the genetically engineered crops, corn and soy, and now, of course, so many different commodity crops that you could just douse and spray over top with glyphosate, and they would not die because they are genetically engineered to be resistant to it. And so that led to this exponential huge growth in the use of glyphosate, because there's now a way to use it throughout the growing season that there never was before. And so we saw this explosion of use. Now it is sprayed on 285 million acres. That's just agricultural. There's another 21 million pounds that are used non-agriculturally. And that's, for scale, is the size of three Californias. So it's a huge area that we use. It's the most widely used weed killer in the world. And so it's no surprise that it is now everywhere in so many of our waterways, in our own bodies. And we get exposed, as I know you mentioned in the beginning, through eating food, as well as some people get even bigger exposures, like those using it, landscapers and farm workers.
Well, given that it's covering the earth to the extent that it's covering the earth, there's a lot of money involved in this. One of the first times that I became aware of the situation was I was having breakfast with a farmer in rural Missouri, and we were speaking at a conference. And so he told me the story of his experiencing fighting Monsanto. His name was Percy Smizer. And so he went through this incredible experience because Monsanto came to him and they found that none of the weeds, none of the canola that was growing in his ditch was killed when he sprayed with glyphosate on it. And that indicated that it was Monsanto's Roundup Ready canola seed. And so they took Percy Smizer to court and tried to take his property away from this errant canola. And so what you saw was a ruthless corporation trying to take over farmland all over the place. They were successful, weren't they?
Well, they did have a campaign, yes, of suing farmers who were contaminated with their own product, their own IP. So there's this, you know, one of the huge problems with this technology is that one company owns the patent to it, meaning they own the life that is the seed, but they can't control it. It obviously, you know, blows in the wind, and there's all these, you know, instances of people who do not want it on their property getting this Roundup Ready trait. They have largely, I think we need to update the numbers, but I know they've stopped suing farmers.
Okay, yeah. Can you hold that for just a sec? We're going to take a quick break. Right back, folks. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson with Amy Van Zoun, who is a senior attorney, Center for Food Safety, and you. Right back.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
So Monsanto became very, very rich and very, very powerful with the development of the genetic technology to infuse in plants that would allow them to withstand glyphosate herbicide. So you could spray your crop with Roundup, kill all the weeds, but not the crop, and became hugely, hugely powerful and successful throughout farm country, and at one time even had a campaign to track down those who were cheating by planting illegal seeds or something. Now, did they actually continue that, Amy Van Saun?
Well, some farmers chose to fight back and actually took them to court, trying to get the court to say, this is wrong, you can't keep suing us when we get, you know, inadvertently contaminated with your product. And while they did not win in court, Monsanto did promise, you know, before the court that they would stop doing these kinds of lawsuits. You know, they, of course, like in the court of public opinion, they look very bad suing farmers, the very people that they hold up as who they're trying to help. And, you know, like the little guy versus the big corporation. So it certainly was a very bad look for them. And they did say they would stop doing it. Now, that said, like I said before the break, I do think we need to update, you know, our numbers on that and make sure they really, in fact, have stopped suing farmers. But the fact is that the contamination continues, and it's a huge problem for farmers, especially seed growers, who are trying to create a product like many of the seed growers here in Oregon who grow, you know, real veggie and fruit type seeds, you know, of stuff you actually plant in your garden and that humans eat, from getting contaminated from these GE crops, because a lot of times you need two seasons to grow for seeds. So if your seed crop is contaminated, you're done. You can't sell it. So it's a huge problem. Not to mention the weeds that are now resistant to Roundup. Yeah. And to glyphosate. So that's caused, you know, the contamination of harvests, wheat, and of seeds, and these super weeds has cost billions of dollars to American farmers.
Everything seems to come at a cost, and there are costs to glyphosate. And one of them appears to be human health, which is really how people have stood up and said, hey, what's in this for us other than food that has been, you know, sprayed with herbicides and pesticides? And what is in it for us? So apparently there is cancer in it for us, right?
Well, there's definitely evidence that people who are exposed to glyphosate have this higher risk of developing specifically non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which is one form of cancer, although there are other potential cancer, you know, and kidney and liver toxin issues. Now, when you're getting exposed through dietary exposures by, you know, just the residues on food, it is much less. So the biggest risks are to people who are using the stuff, people who are spraying it or being sprayed by it. Especially, again, many of our clients are farm workers who don't know what all pesticides they're being sprayed with, but definitely are getting sprayed, getting this drift of glyphosate. So getting it on your skin or inhaling it is, you know, the biggest risk of exposure. But we don't know what is really happening to our bodies from this lower level of constant dietary exposure. There is a lot of, you know, research happening. And I think, you know, one thing people are looking at is like, what is this doing to our gut microbiome? So there's a lot of long-term things that could be happening that we don't even fully understand, which is why many people avoid foods that have any pesticide residues on them.
There you go. Now, I think I recall seeing and reading that Monsanto claims that when you eat glyphosate, your body disassembles the chemicals or something like that, but otherwise it causes no harm.
Well, of course, they say that it causes no harm. In fact, they used to say it was so safe you could drink it. which is absolutely not true. And they will deny having said that. But, you know, they say, oh, it's as safe as table salt. Well, you know what happens if you have too much table salt? It'll kill you. So there's no, it's not a question of, you know, the question is how much is safe or not safe. And without knowing exactly what it is doing to our bodies, even in those low levels, there's, you know, I don't want to feed it to my family.
Amen. Well, the struggle, it seems, began when the European folks, I guess it was the World Health Organization, did a study, and they said glyphosate is a probable cause of human cancer. But Monsanto didn't like that.
No, they did not. Yes, that was IARC, and this is the foremost cancer researchers in the world. And this panel of folks included someone from the EPA, actually, and they looked at all of the studies out there. They did, you know, like a big meta-analysis. So let's look at all the studies that are there and what do they all show together? And that's where they came to that conclusion of probably carcinogenic. And so that did prompt, you know, a lot of medical researchers and everyone to be paying attention to this issue. But Monsanto, of course, started a campaign of downplaying IARC's finding and bullying the EPA to continue it, you know, holding its party line that it doesn't cause cancer and that there's no risk at all. So, you know, they even went so far as colluding to try to stop an independent study by the National Institutes of Health that, you know, they eventually got kind of neutered and delayed. Mm-hmm. But it's been, I mean, it's unsurprising that a ruthless giant corporation trying to protect its biggest cash cow is going to, you know, do everything it can to downplay what medical researchers and preeminent scientists have found across the world.
And Monsanto had a wonderfully big, huge, giant reputation for being a bully with a lot of different things. So everywhere you looked and everyone you talked to, when you mentioned the word Monsanto, everybody would kind of cringe. And yet somebody persevered and took this World Health Organization study and went to war with it. Was that you? Were you involved in that? Center for Food Safety?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'd like to think that Center for Food Safety has had somewhat of a hand in making Monsanto a dirty word, as we've been fighting them since 1997. But yes, I mean, we've absolutely taken that IARC 2015 probable carcinogen study and used it as much as we can, especially in front of EPA, to say, look, like, you can't ignore this real-world evidence that's out there. And, you know, EPA's own Office of Research and Development, which is separate from its pesticide office, found the same things. They said, you know, based on these people getting NHL in the real world, we can't say that there's no cancer risk here. Like, there is a cancer risk. So, yeah, we've absolutely, you know, used that, you know, it's a very convincing piece of evidence. So EPA not following it is, again, just Monsanto's influence.
Mm-hmm. So what did they say? What did EPA say when you laid the evidence on the table? Did they look at the evidence at all, or did they look at it and say, those guys in Europe don't know what they're doing?
Basically, yeah, the latter. And we went into some detail on this in front of the court, who found in our favor, again, in this recent decision by the Ninth Circuit. And EPA, again, discounted and downplayed. They said, well, they didn't have the same standards for, you know, what evidence they would look at as we do at the EPA. And, you know, so we don't have to listen to their conclusion. And, you know, some of what's really hypocritical there is EPA would rely on studies that it didn't even have the data from and just believe the chemical company and say, oh, yeah, that's what you found? Great, you know? So,
isn't that the way the government works, though? They don't have any real labs themselves, do they? From what I understand, everything is pretty much generally recognized as safe if those who make it say it's so.
Ah, well, you cite the standard from the that the FDA has used for a lot of these genetically engineered foods. And yeah, you're right. You know, so EPA, it's not that they have their own labs, but they have the power under the federal pesticide law that Congress gave them to call for the data and to say to a pesticide, a registrant, as they're known, they want to register their pesticide, so Monsanto or whoever, to say, do these studies and then come back to us with the results. So, you know, the question is, are they getting the full results? Are they getting the data that underlies the results? They absolutely have the power to do that. That was part of our concern with this re-registration, that, you know, this reapproval they just did, because they were saying, oh, yeah, glyphosate is fine, it's safe, but without getting a number of studies, like assessing how much gets into your skin if you get exposed on the job. So there were things that they could have called for. And, you know, then Monsanto would have had an obligation to perform those tests, and, you know, they just didn't.
Okay. So we see things that we want to see, and we don't see things that we don't want to see. And Monsanto's there to encourage us to see the things that they want us to see. That about it?
Yep, that about sums it up. Yep, the EPA can only assess the data that it has, so if it doesn't ask for it, then it doesn't have it. Unless, of course, there's independent studies out there, and that, you know, again, is like I was talking about the evidence of NHL in real people mm-hmm. who have used Roundup.
How did you fight Monsanto, or which is now, of course, Bayer AG? Because legal fight must have been going on for quite a while.
Yes. So we mainly focus on government actions. So all of these genetically engineered crops, all of these pesticides, historically have had to be approved before they go out for commercialization. So that's where we have gone, because, you know, we have leverage there. We can go to federal court. And, you know, there's a basic administrative law that says that these agencies have to make logical decisions that are not arbitrary and that are supported by evidence. So that's where we have focused almost 99% of our work is going, you know, when EPA first started USDA first started approving genetically engineered crops that were engineered to withstand glyphosate, and when EPA does these pesticide approvals. But, you know, since glyphosate was first approved in 1974, we have not had a chance for a long time to address its use until this 2020 decision that said, we looked at the new evidence, everything's still fine, it's totally safe. And so that was a historic kind of moment for us to be able to take EPA to court and say, no, there's the evidence does not say that this stuff is safe, and your decision is totally arbitrary and wrong.
So... where did you start with the court case against the EPA? That sounds like fun to me.
Where do we start? So, under this federal pesticide law, when EPA makes one of these decisions, if there was sort of a public comment period, public notice and comment, which there was, and we did lots of commenting. Our expert scientist on staff, Bill Fries, has been following the glyphosate and cancer problem for decades. He's incredibly knowledgeable. And so, you know, we did all this commenting. And then once the decision is made, you only have 90 days to petition directly to the Court of Appeals. So it's a very fast moving process, unlike a lot of other federal law. And so we have to go straight to the Court of Appeals. You don't do your first kind of trial court. You just go right to the direct petition, and then it's all briefing. So it's all, you know, a lot of writing of you marshal all the evidence that the EPA produces a big record of everything that they have that went into making the decision, and you review all of that evidence, and it's many thousands, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of pages, and then write the briefs. And so you don't get a ton of space when you're doing this to the Court of Appeals, because generally this is, you know, an appeal from someone losing at a trial court level. So it's a very weird, it's a little bit weird because they're hearing it for the first time as a trial court would. And so, yeah, it's a very specific kind of legal writing that we really enjoy doing. And we got one argument before the court, and this is a 3-judge panel. And so that happened in January of this year, and you can watch it on YouTube if you would like to. I got to argue it, which was very exciting. And yeah, you get, you know, probably 10 minutes, I think, is what I got, because we were actually, our case was consolidated with an NRDC challenge. And so we split time. And so you prep for weeks to have this 10 minutes of time before the court. And luckily we got to go a bit longer, as they're doing these days over Zoom. They let you kind of, they might ask you a lot of questions and like, let you talk for longer. So yeah, that's it. It's a couple of briefs back and forth and one short argument before the 3 judges, and then you wait for their decision. So
the information we've been waiting. The information that you put out must be incredibly complex, because you're dealing with incredibly complex chemicals, complex chemical reactions. Now, when you get 10 minutes in front of 3 judges, do those judges know? Have a chemical background, or how were they able to? It seems like a very confusing process. I wouldn't know what to do with 10 minutes, and I would listen to you. Well, we'll pick that up when we come back from this break. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio program. Today we're talking about the spectacular victory won by plaintiffs in their lawsuit against Monsanto for their glyphosate herbicide giving them cancer. We're talking about big bucks, many millions of dollars won on behalf of these plaintiffs by some very astute attorneys. Do stay tuned, right back.
History buffs, this tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place aboard the USS Dale at Eniwetok, February 1944.
We got detached for some close-in shore bombardment on one of the little coral islands. From a distance, they're just little slivers of white and green separating the blue sea and sky. Somehow we found ourselves blasting away with our 5-inchers from one side of the island, while the big old battleships on the other side were booming away with their giant 16-inch rifles. Trouble was, the trajectory of their rounds was flat, so a bunch of those 16-inch shells hit that round slip of coral and ricocheted right off in our direction. You could hear them roaring past right over our head, and they didn't sound friendly at all. Captain said, "Let's get the hell out of here."
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com. Talesfromatincan.com.
Come on, you watch the news. Be prepared to pay more taxes. Then if you owe back taxes or haven't filed in a few years, get ready. The IRS, the largest collection agency in the world, will be coming after you. With the power to collect taxes by any means they want to. Hey, they can freeze your bank account, your passport, even padlock your business. Oh, good times. Look, if the IRS claims you owe them $5,000 or more in back taxes and they're coming after you, don't panic. Call my friends at Get a Tax Lawyer first. Their job is to negotiate with the IRS and save you money. They're experts at it. That's all they do. And you can trust them. In some cases, they have reduced a $50,000 tax bill to less than $1,000. If you owe the IRS $5,000 or more in back taxes, call now for a free consultation.
Call 800-661-5096. 800-661-5096. 800-661-5096. That's 800-661-5096.
Are you nearly maxed out on your credit cards? It doesn't matter if you're using your credit cards for fun or to survive. At the end of the month, your statements come in, and you can either pay them or you can't. If you can't, late fees and interest rates get tacked on, and now you're struggling just to make the minimum payment due. Do you feel trapped? Am I talking to you? Good, because I personally researched some companies that can help you. They may be able to reduce your credit card balances by 50% and stop the late fees. If you qualify, please call our special debt hotline number right now for a complimentary, free 5-minute consultation. Deal with your credit card problem now before it gets much worse and put more money back in your pocket. Trust me, I've been there too. Call right now.
800-370-8128. 800-370-8128. 800-370-8128. That's 800-370-8128.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, I am very curious about those three judges on the Ninth District Court of Appeals. How is it possible that they could sit in judgment of something so complicated with a 10-minute presentation?
Well, you know, one of the jobs that we have as public interest environmental attorneys is to take what is a complex environmental or human health problem and scientific issue and make it clear for a layperson, because these judges, you know, generally don't have a science background. So it can be quite a challenge to take something that is, like you said, so complex and make it clear to them, and clear enough so that they will, like, they'll stick their neck out and rule for you. And in this case, there's a lot that goes on behind the scenes before this sort of performance of this, you know, oral argument at court. They have all your briefing, they have all the evidence before them, and they have clerks who, you know, do all this. They do all this reading, they do their own research, they write for the judges, you know, memos about what's going on. So some judges show up very prepared, and they've read everything, and they have very detailed questions, and they're really with it with you. And that did happen here, which was incredibly lucky for us because it is such a complex issue. And sometimes you show up and they have no idea what you're talking about. So you really have to kind of pivot and say, like, here's the most important thing for you to remember when you go back and do all this reading and actually write your decision. So here, you know, go ahead.
Yeah, you're a storyteller.
Yes, exactly. You got to tell a story. Why should they care about this issue and what it means? Why should they rule in your favor? Without that story, it certainly could just go way into the weeds, pun intended.
So you took, pun intended, pun accepted. So you took, you took this incredibly complex issue of how the EPA was going about evaluating glyphosate. And you took it to the three-judge panel and said, look what these guys are doing. It's not right. And the judges said?
They said they totally agreed with us. They said what EPA did was internally inconsistent. They had a lot of great phrases about how it was contrary to their own experts and their own guidelines. And the 54-page opinion goes into a lot of detail on the science. I was really impressed reading it. I said, you know, I think this sounds smarter than my briefs, honestly. They really dove in and really looked at what EPA did and what EPA said compared to the evidence before EPA, and got into the, again, I'm sorry, into the weeds about, like, the animal feeding studies and the ways in which EPA discounted the tumors they found and all these sort of technical terms and things. So we were incredibly happy and impressed with how far the judges dug down into the issue. And so, then, of course, rightfully found that we were correct.
So there was a lot of money involved in yours and the other finding as well, correct?
Well, in this case, you know, we're not looking for, like, money damages or anything. Our remedy is that EPA goes back and redoes its assessment and does it correctly this time. So unlike the cases where people are suing Monsanto directly and saying, you didn't warn me about the cancer and now I have cancer, pay my bills and also pay punitive damages, that's not this kind of case.
Oh, okay.
So there is money at stake insofar as for Bayer and its liability for this thing. And if EPA were to come out and actually admit that there's a cancer risk, then that would mean they would have to, logically, restrict how glyphosate is used. So that would have impacts, of course, on the sales.
So this is getting very interesting then. What was the Supreme Court just found on behalf of two plaintiffs and refused to consider Monsanto's appeal on those two issues, correct?
Yes. So the issues that went up that were the same in both of the Hardeman and Pilliod cases were EPA or Monsanto claiming, okay, we lost on the state-based failure to warn claim. So people saying, you know, I have rights as a consumer under my state laws, and when you sell me a product that might hurt or kill me, like, you need to tell me and warn me about that. And so Monsanto's saying, well, EPA, the federal agency, is the only one that sets labels for pesticides. And it is true that under the federal pesticide statute, that's what EPA does. They create the they, you know, approve the label language. That is the law. Then that is like what is legal use of a pesticide, is you have to follow the label. And states are not allowed to change that language. So they're saying by doing these sort of failure to warn cases, you're actually going against this federal preemption from the federal pesticide law. But there's existing Supreme Court precedent, Bates case, that says no, states can, you know, restrict pesticide use above and beyond. They just can't change the label language. So they were trying to basically overturn that case. Right. And luckily, the Supreme Court just didn't take up the issue, which, you know, in this Supreme Court day and age, we don't want them to take up anything
so
at all.
It seems as though the Monsanto Corporation, vis-a-vis Bayer AG now, is in a rock, caught between a rock and a hard place, because it sounds to me like they're going to have to label glyphosate as a potential carcinogen all over the country. Is that right?
Well, I'll give you the lawyer answer. I'm sorry. It depends. they obviously know that they have a lot of liability, because this is just the tip of the iceberg of the people who have sued them. It doesn't even include any farm workers. And there's a good reason for that. Farm workers are afraid to come forward.
There's 100,000 plaintiffs on the boards.
Yeah. And that doesn't include any farm workers, wow, is my understanding. So there's so many more people that are affected that aren't even part of this liability. It's for that reason that Bayer did announce that by next year, they're going to stop selling Roundup to home use, residential use folks. So people, mm-hmm, like me who might spray, well, I would never spray it on my garden, but, you know, for regular home users, not, you know, ag use. So they are trying to limit their liability in that way.
A quick interjection with respect to using glyphosate around the home. You don't need to. Just get yourself a big jug,
absolutely,
of white vinegar, pour it in a spray bottle with about a teaspoon of soap, and spray your weeds, and that'll kill your weeds. And it works.
Damn right it does.
And it doesn't kill you.
Yeah, you know, you know what else works is pulling them up.
That works too. But only when the soil's soft, right? Only when the soil's soft.
Yeah.
When the soil gets hard, good luck on pulling anything up.
Good luck, yeah. And, you know, the ones that are in the cracks.
Yeah, I
saw a hilarious clickbait article the other day that said, you know, miracle way to get rid of weeds, and it was just pull them up. I'm like, okay, I already knew that one.
But it's
absolutely unnecessary for home use. And I mean, it's not okay. Let me back up. None of these synthetic pesticides are necessary to grow food. We have organic production, which doesn't use any of them, and grows beautiful, healthy, nutritious food that's good for the earth. So none of them are necessary at all. I know that our industrial ag system is built around using these pesticides, glyphosate included. But, you know, our whole mission at Center for Food Safety is to dismantle that industrial system, because it's killing us. So we need to shift away from that.
I invited the industrial folks to sit in on an edition of the Food Chain to talk about this from their perspective. Crickets. They're not saying anything. Why not?
Well, they don't want to admit what, you know, I think you alluded to earlier, is that we, the people, don't see any benefit.
Those of us who eat food, right?
Those of us who eat food, nor really do farmers in the long run, right? We're on this pesticide treadmill, and they keep saying we're going to win the war against pests, but we don't. We never will. There's evolution. That's real, right? Monsanto might want to deny that evolution exists, but weeds now, there's dozens of weeds across millions of acres in this country that glyphosate won't touch. It won't kill them at all because they've evolved to resist it. And so now Monsanto is telling us, oh, spray this older, more toxic herbicide in addition to glyphosate. That'll take care of that problem for you. Like dicamba. And I'm sure you've heard of that.
Sure.
Crazy drift problems, destroying so many other crops and gardens. Like, so that's their solution. They don't care about the American farmer.
I also think they have dicamba resistant crops too.
Oh, I'm sure there is starting to become resistant.
And then they have
stacked
genetic genes or stacked genes in crops so that you can use all of the above.
Yep.
So you get,
and we did a,
go ahead.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So you can, you the farmer go buy your soybean that's resistant to both glyphosate and dicamba. And then you buy both of those products and you can spray them both, causing all sorts of damage. And we actually won that case as well in front of the Ninth Circuit against EPA, again, for approving this new use of dicamba over the top of genetically engineered crops. Mm-hmm. Because beforehand, again, like glyphosate before the 90s, your crops would die if you sprayed it on them. So now that there's these stacked trait resistant ones, but we beat them back, and their findings that this was a beneficial technology. Their cost benefit analysis that they do is, ignored all the harms that dicamba has done in drift and how impossible it would be to follow their insanely long label that made it so, tried to restrict it so much that it wouldn't do this drift damage, but, impossible to follow. And the Ninth Circuit agreed with us on that as well.
Speaking of the Ninth Circuit, you seem to have found a friend there with respect to your side of the political spectrum. Wouldn't it behoove Bayer to find a more friendly appeals court to deal with?
Well, it's funny you should say that, because in the dicamba situation, EPA then went and reapproved it. And, it's the plaintiffs suing are trade organizations, but, funded, obviously, by Monsanto and friends. Went and brought a case in D.C. preemptively to try to get us out of the Ninth Circuit. So, yes, that is absolutely real. There is forum shopping, as we call it, that they have done to try to get out of the Ninth Circuit. We're based here, so this is why we bring cases here. It's not because we're trying to, get a more friendly judge. But, of course, the Ninth Circuit historically has been more progressive. As evidenced by the states that it represents. However, the Trump administration was quite good at appointing federal judges. So there are a lot of, and they focused on the Ninth Circuit for that exact reason. There are a lot of Trump appointed judges on the Ninth Circuit now. So the friendliness to the environment really depends. It depends on who you draw.
Yeah. So you have won an appeal at the Ninth Circuit. You are forcing the Environmental Protection Agency to go back and look at the science. Is there anything in your victory that will compel the EPA to look at the evidence you would like to have them look at? Or will they just do what they did before and keep kicking the can down the road, I guess?
Well, the court, again, laid out in a lot of detail all the ways in which EPA's decision was not logical or not supported by substantial evidence. That's the legal standard here. So EPA has to come back and make a new decision that is supported by substantial evidence. So yes, they could say the exact same thing, but they have to back it up in some other way than they already have, because they know we will take them right back to court if they don't do that. So, this is sort of, in the case of chlorpyrifos, for example, the court said, if you're going to set these tolerances, because this is a brain damaging chemical for children, if you're going to allow this to be used and have people eat residues of it, then you need to come up with actual justification for how that's safe. And they couldn't do it. So you know, I think what our hope is that the EPA will actually, you know, look at the evidence before it, stop discounting all the evidence before it, and change its designation on cancer risk, which will mean that they'll have to, you know, again, look at that cost-benefit analysis. Here's all this cancer harm against the supposed benefits of glyphosate. And does that mean we just allow it to continue to be used the same way, or do we restrict it? So, of course, our hope is that they will restrict it or, of course, take it entirely off the shelves. But, you know, that would be a complete 180, of course, from their current position. But they do have to go back and do something else, is the short answer.
Given the amount of money and given the need of industrial agriculture for glyphosate, what would happen if you succeeded in getting rid of glyphosate?
Well, people, you know, farmers would have to rely on other methods of weed suppression.
And they could probably do it if they really wanted.
And they could. They could. And there's no evidence that a lot of the, you know, they say this, you know, is increasing yields and things like that. But, you know, again, there's organic agriculture.
There you go.
So it does not use glyphosate. It does not need it.
It can
it
be
works
done.
With nature,
it
not
can
against
be
nature.
Done. And the Center for Food Safety is going to make them do it. Amy, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate your comments and your help getting us to understand this incredibly difficult issue. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.